From the Partnership for Public Service, you're listening to Transition Lab, a behind-the-scenes look at presidential transitions. I'm David Marchik. Today on Transition Lab, we have Admiral Thad Allen. Admiral Allen served for 40 years in the Coast Guard, including as Commandant. For today's podcast, we're focused on emergency planning in government, a subject that obviously could not be more relevant since we're taping this during the coronavirus outbreak. Admiral Allen has literally found himself in the middle of every major recent disaster in the United States. He led the Coast Guard's command of the Atlantic Seaboard on September 11th. He oversaw the disaster response efforts for Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. And after he retired, he was appointed by President Obama to lead the federal response to the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Time magazine called Thad the master of disaster. And he also served on the board of the Partnership for Public Service, the organization that sponsors these podcasts. Thad, I want to thank you for your 40 years of public service. In every crisis, there are heroes. In 9/11, it was the first responders, the firefighters, and the police. In today's crisis, it's the career government officials at the federal, state, and local level, as well as the healthcare providers who are literally risking their lives to serve the public. So let me thank you for your service and your career as a public servant. Let me also tell our listeners that we unfortunately had a technical problem during this, so we had to interrupt our podcast during the middle and move to the phone line. So the quality of the podcast is not what you're used to. Apologize for that. Admiral Allen, thank you very much for being here and welcome. So here's my first question. When you were 22, you were on a vessel that caught fire and you escaped. When you were 23, you were stationed in the Everglades and were part of the rescue for Eastern Airlines Flight 401, which crashed into the Everglades. You were in charge of the Atlantic Seaboard on 9/11 and dealt with that crisis. And then you were appointed for the Katrina hurricane and the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. Does disaster follow you, or do you follow disaster?
Well, I've been accused of that in the past. I think it just happened to be where I was at and what happened. But in each case, it was an honor to be able to serve the public.
Our work at the partnership is on effectiveness in government and smooth political transitions. In your view, were our political leaders and our government ready for this crisis? And were they prepared to implement a crisis response?
That's a great question. And I think it's probably the most important question to answer because it drives the solution for the crisis. Every crisis is an exercise in applied civics, and you have to look at the interlocking, overlapping, and sometimes gapped laws, legislative authorities, appropriations, and so forth, and be able to see what kind of framework is there for the response, and is that really responsive to the needs of the American public and what you're trying to do.
So what would you say is the scope of this crisis, and is there any precedent?
Well, it's unprecedented in that it's impacting all 50 states and territories of the United States simultaneously. Usually, disasters, while they may be large scale, as Hurricane Katrina or Superstorm Sandy, are localized at least regionally. In this case, you have an omnipresent threat to all 50 states simultaneously that requires the entire integration, not only of the federal government, but the private sector, and then vertically down through the state, territorial, and tribal governments.
I recall during the Katrina crisis, it wasn't President Bush's finest hour, and the Democrats were very, very critical of him. And frankly, the crisis hurt him. So there has been politicization of crises before, but you're saying this is much worse than it's ever been?
Well, there's certainly a level of preparedness that always exists in government because you have the continuity of career employees. The thing that has bothered me, and it's bothered me for almost three decades now, is the more bifurcated and politicized we become as a nation, it seems like we've started to lose the dividing line between what's a campaign and what's governing. And when you try and run an operational response to a disaster or a crisis, and you confuse that with campaigning, you run the risk of failing at both. And I think over the years, and this is not restricted to this particular administration, I think that's something we really have to watch out for in government.
One of the things you've talked about quite a bit is the importance of communication, clear communication in a crisis. How did you approach communication with a public that was scared, anxious, and doesn't know who to trust, including trusting the government.
Look, I have several principles on communication I try and follow, and these are general guidelines. They're not hard and fast rules. But one is to remove ambiguity wherever you can regarding the situation. The other is to create clarity. And ambiguity and clarity both need to be addressed, and they aren't quite the same thing. And the other thing is transparency of information. I have an old saying, transparency of information breeds self-correcting behavior. And you have to create a sense of credibility and honesty with the public if you're going to get them to buy in and have credibility in the response.
Let me ask you how you balanced different imperatives. A president obviously wants to look commanding, authoritative, but is also focused on his or her politics. The person in charge of crisis response has one job, which is to solve the crisis. And clearly we're seeing some differences today, for example, between President Bush and, say, Anthony Fauci and other healthcare professionals. Did you find yourself in similar situations where you were running various emergency response efforts and the president had a different agenda or different constituency?
Well, the president is always going to have political accountability to the constituency. And if they're going to do that and do it to the utmost of their ability, they need to be relevant to their constituents and be seen as relevant. And any professional that's involved in a crisis working for a president needs to understand that. The person running the crisis, which I believe should be a subject matter expert that is designated by the president to carry out the response and then be held accountable for what they're doing, separates the president from the operations. The president provides oversight, can remove that person if he doesn't feel they're doing a good job. But then you have to give that individual the ability to speak openly with the public and handle the problem. If you don't do that, the president becomes personally identified to the outcome. And if they really think about it, that's not something they want either.
One of the things that you did during the Katrina crisis was that you dealt directly with people who lost their houses, their livelihoods, their jobs. Some people lost everything. What was it like to deal with people on a person-to-person basis? It's a much different skill set than, say, sitting in your office, commanding a big organization, or being a leader of an agency.
Well, I thought it was incredibly important to try and understand at a human level how these events were impacting people. I remember walking through Waveland in Bay St. Louis, Mississippi, where the eye of the storm came ashore with Katrina, and I found a woman sitting on the foundation of what used to be a house, and I stopped and talked to her, and she said, I come over every day just looking for things that still might be here that'll help me remember what our life was like. And for me to see her go through the agony and the daily routine of trying to find pieces of what was helped me understand the human impact, and the fact that I asked the question and she knew who I was indicated to her and others that I was demonstrating by my behavior what I thought my responsibilities were and how I need to make a human connection.
How did you rebuild the trust with the people you're trying to serve? The initial response, for example, in Katrina was very poor, and people lost faith in their government. They felt like the government wasn't serving them. They were stuck in the Superdome. They were out of their houses. They were stuck on the streets. I literally remember people walking up the bayou with all of their belongings in a hefty bag. But then you came in and slowly built credibility and trust. What were your strategies to do that? And did you feel like you earned the trust of the people of New Orleans throughout the crisis?
I thought we did, but it took a few days to do it. We need to remember that we spent a week pouring resources in and around New Orleans. I'll use that as the example. And there didn't appear to be any abatement of the problems, and we had the problems in the Superdome and the Convention Center. What I tried to do was create unity of effort, both horizontally across government and vertically down to the state and local government, and stand shoulder to shoulder with the Director of Homeland Security from the city of New Orleans. We created a joint planning cell. We put it right on the dock next to the USS Iwo Jima that had been docked there to provide support. And we basically integrated all of our planning efforts, including the Louisiana National Guard. So when you get everybody in the same room and they're all focused on the problem together, you're going to get a more optimal result than you would otherwise. And we were able to, in my view, about 72 to 96 hours to stabilize the response.
One of the challenges that you dealt with, and I think President Trump and others are dealing with today, is the different responsibilities between the federal, state, and local governments. So the federal government may lead the effort, but really the states and localities have all the resources on the ground. How do you balance the role of the federal government, the states, and the cities, and how do you get everybody lined up?
Well, I've said many times that each one of these events, and especially the one we're dealing with right now, becomes an exercise in applied civics, and sometimes we end up load testing the Constitution and what the basic authorities mean. But I always start with the 10th Amendment, which basically says that all powers not granted to the federal government are reserved to the states, and specifically disaster response, police powers, health and sanitation, and those types of things are a state responsibility. The question is, how do you move beyond that if the problem exceeds the ability of the state to respond to? And that's done usually through a disaster and emergency declaration that allows the federal government to come in to assist. But even during Katrina, my role was not to usurp the mayor or the governor. It was to help them carry out their responsibilities. A lot of times this has to be negotiated because the government comes in with different authorities and jurisdictions based on the departments, different appropriation sources, and so forth. And you really got to put all the stuff on the table and knit it all together for a successful response.
The crisis you dealt with were very different. On 9/11, we were obviously attacked by foreign parties and foreign interests. In Hurricane Katrina, there was a total loss of continuity of government in New Orleans and parts of Louisiana. And then for the BP oil spill, it was an environmental disaster, one that affected the economy and the vitality of the region, but also the national psyche. So how did you approach these crises differently?
Well, the hurricane response, in my view, was guided by the fact that disaster response is a local government responsibility and the role of the federal government is to support them. It got very dicey at times because the mayor and I didn't always agree on what the right course of action was, for instance, when people should return to the city. But I never put myself in a place where I was usurping the mayor or using his authority, so we had to work through that. And frankly, it got testy at times, and we did our best to work through it.
Let me just probe on that. So you thought people should not return to the city, and he thought people should return to the city more quickly?
The city still had water in certain places. There were there was lack of potable water, electricity, sewer, and so forth. There was a desire politically to have people return to the city as fast as possible. My counsel was to do it safely and in a controlled manner where the public safety wasn't put at risk. And frankly, we didn't agree on it, but we worked through it.
One of the similarities between today's situation and Katrina was that the local systems were overwhelmed. In Katrina, the police force, the firefighters, the city government, they had no communication capacity and the continuity of government was basically broken. They were overwhelmed by the crisis. Today, our hospitals are getting overwhelmed. The local communities are getting overwhelmed. What advice would you have to state, local, and federal officials on how to avoid the systems being totally overloaded and then be able to serve the American people?
Well, the scale of this event is so large, it's going to severely test the supply chains that are related to any hospital activities in all 50 states and territories of the United States. And at every level, starting with a community hospital or a city and moving up to county, state, and so forth, there's going to have to be some kind of a way to prioritize the resources you have and then allocate scarcity, basically. And it appears, at least for a while, and I'm not intimately involved in the response, but it appears private sector is not going to be able to gear up to get this stuff manufactured in time. So there's going to have to be some really tough decisions made. But the best decisions that are made are the ones that are made locally and closest to the problem. And the further you get up, then it requires a prioritization. And at some point, the federal government may have to decide which states should be allocated the resources that they have to the highest need at that time. That's a very, very difficult position to be in. What I dealt with during the oil spill doesn't even compare to what we're dealing with now, but I had governors complaining that one state was getting more boom to protect the shoreline than another, and we were trying to allocate scarcity. And it became not only an operational issue, but a very, very divisive political issue as well.
You worked for both President Bush on Katrina and then President Obama on the Deepwater Horizon crisis. How did their leadership styles differ, and how did you approach dealing with each of them?
Well, I had a great working relationship with both. They both have very different leadership styles. But the one thing they both had in common was, you know, subject to the political responsibility they had to their constituents and to manage the politics of the issue, both gave me a pretty wide range to figure out what the problem was, to solve it, make recommendations to them, speak frankly to the American people and be held accountable and to be removed if I wasn't doing the job. If there was a common denominator across both presidents, it was their willingness to give me that authority and then hold me accountable.
One of the things that's unique about this crisis is the existence of daily news conferences by the president with the coronavirus task force. Did you do daily news conferences with Presidents Bush or Obama?
For both events, I generally did almost daily news conferences, depending on the tempo of operations. And then because these were regionally specific, the presidents would visit once in a while, once a week or something like that. And then when they came down, there would be a public briefing and then questions and answers with the press. And most of the time at that point, the presidents would take questions as well. So it was a kind of a two-phase thing. I would handle the daily interaction with the media and the press. The presidents would visit, and I would brief them and escort them, and we would have a conversation together.
Well, they pretty much let you lead the communication. Is that best practice to have the crisis managers, the experts in crisis management, lead communications?
They did. In many ways, the oil spill was more political because the private sector, it was an industrial accident. So there was a higher level of politics related to, say, the policies on oil and gas drilling and those types of things. So I would say there was more political discussion during the oil spill. But in fact, both presidents allowed me the freedom to act in the best interest of the country and communicate with the American public.
Well, my final question is, you came out of retirement once to deal with the oil spill. If you were called today to help lead this crisis, are you ready to jump in again and help the country?
Well, some of the basic tenets that allow me to be successful may or may not exist in this current administration. One would be to speak freely and honestly with the American people about what's going on and maintain their credibility in the response. If those conditions are somehow able to be met, I would always consider helping the country out. I would note, though, that being over 70 years old, I'm at one of the risk populations, so that probably would have to be taken into account.
I think you should get ready for that phone call, Thad. Well, let me thank you, Admiral Allen, for your service to the country, and thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
If you like Transition Lab, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.